The latest novel from Gary Steingart, the author of The Russian Debutante's Handbook and Absurdistan, is called Super Sad True Love Story. It takes place in a United States that's no longer the world's greatest power. China is the ascendant, and the dollar is pegged to the yuan. New York City is dotted with National Guard checkpoints manned by soldiers with rifles, and you can ride business class on the subway. Leonard Abramoff, the protagonist, works in a rejuvenation research outfit where money will buy you a shot at eternal life. And that's just the beginning. It's published by Random House. I'm delighted that it brings Gary Steingart back to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Great to be back.
Super Sad True Love Story is set in the future. How far in the future did you imagine it to be?
Well, so you have a completely illiterate America falling apart. As you said, the yuan is dominant. China rules the whole country. Next Tuesday, I think, is what we're aiming for.
Well, the New York Times has become the New York Lifestyle Times. And what's happened to hard news in this new world?
In this world, everyone is sort of a journalist themselves. Everybody streams about their lives, about their weight, their calorie counts, their carb counts, and stuff like that. There is no hard news. And there are no organizations that send people out to find the news. Everything is just about your own life.
You teach writing at Columbia University. I hope your students are better than some of the people here, because not much serious reading is done anymore. People comment that books smell bad.
Yes, a lot of the younger generation in this book, and I think in real life, also does find that books smell pretty bad. A friend of mine who is in her 20s, she calls books doorstops. And her friends call them doorstops because that's what they're most useful for.
They're still reading, aren't they? They're just reading Kindles and other e-books?
No, I don't think they're reading. I think there's a lot of internet shopping that's a lot of fun. There's a lot of rating. In this book, in Super Sad True Love Story, everybody always rates one another. So the moment you enter into a room, let's say, you know you're the 13th ugliest person in the room, and you have the 8th best credit rating and the 9th best personality.
There's an app, actually, on an iPhone-like thing that's called an apparat.
Yes, it's called the apparat in this book.
And that reveals everything. You walk into a room and people immediately know where you rank in the hierarchy.
Where you rank, you know, if you've suffered any child abuse, everything is automatically revealed the moment you walk into a room. Everybody, there is no privacy anymore in this book. Everybody knows everything about everyone else.
I'm not. And then here we have Lenny. He seems to be the last of the readers. Were you inspired at all by Fahrenheit 451?
I was inspired by my life, being the last reader in America, or one of the few, the 100,000 few. Yes, I was inspired by Fahrenheit 451. The difference is, in Fahrenheit 451, the government went out and actually burned the books. Here, it's something a little more insidious. It's not the government. It's the people. They've given up on reading, and there's just no reading being done. And no introspective life, no rumination, no meditation.
Do you see evidence of tech speak in your students' prose?
OMG, I do not. MFG, I guess. I do not. But in the book, there are certain – I've invented several new acronyms like Timatov, think I'm about to openly vomit, and then JBF, which I can't really say on a family radio. Don't. But, you know, it's I've had so much fun with acronyms. It's really interesting. I mean, you know, these kids, for example, at Columbia, the undergrads, they're brilliant, you know, but they're slowly entering the world, the post-literate, post-book world, where their information is constantly being sliced and diced into tiny little pieces. So they're great at multitasking. They're great at understanding 30 different things at once, but they can't put them all together, maybe. And in this book, it's sort of that there's a love story between Lenny, who represents that old generation, and the woman he loves is 15 years younger, which, you know, 15 years, it's not exactly May, December. It's like maybe August, September romance. But already, because of how fast things are moving, their lives are so different that there's really nothing to connect them except some of their rankings are overlap.
Well, they both have refugee parents, immigrant parents, and certain experiences that they share.
Yes, yes, it's true. Both have dysfunctional immigrant parents. And dysfunctional immigrant parents, they're the stuff literature is made of these days.
Your books especially. Now, where did this start? Did this start with thinking about how your students were writing differently than they would have a generation earlier?
No, it started with just noticing that things were changing very quickly and then trying to create the characters. These are the first characters I've written where I really kind of love them. I really care for what happens to them and the way that they interact. You know, my last book had a 325-pound protagonist with a bad circumcision. It was clear that I was putting him through some satiric paces. Here it's a little different. I understand both of them, and I understand how they both want to reach out to one another. It's just that they can't communicate because communication itself has gone out the window. All that's left are the little bleeps, the little electronic digital bleeps that we hear.
Were you writing this when the economic meltdown started?
You know, I started writing this in 2006, and when I started writing this, I thought, oh, my God, okay, things are not going to go well for this country no matter what people say. The banks are going to collapse. I took a ride in a Chevrolet. I said, there's no way this company is going to survive, you know, with these nice Hyundais rolling off the assembly line. And as I started writing it, all these things started happening, and I became very upset because this is the problem, you know, with writing a novel. That there's no present anymore. We live in the future all the time. So I constantly had to make things worse and worse and worse until the whole country falls apart and is bought up by a Norwegian hedge fund.
My guest is Gary Steingart, whose latest novel is called Super Sad True Love Story. It's published by Random House. People talk about the American Restoration Authority, or the ARA. What's that?
The American Restoration Authority is the last-ditch attempt of this government, a pretty authoritarian government. The only party left is called the Bipartisan Party. And it's the American Restoration Authority is the last attempt to get the country together so that it can still compete with China and other places. But they can't even repair the Williamsburg Bridge, which collapses in the course of the book. The infrastructure is another huge problem. Everything just falls apart as the book continues.
Well, the Williamsburg Bridge is probably going to collapse anyway.
I'm afraid to walk on it. I'm afraid to fly over it. It might explode and damage the airplane.
The Secretary of State, Rubenstein, is mentioned more often than the President. So in the New World, would the Secretary of State be the most important diplomat?
That was a little bit of a hyperbole on my part. It really would have been the Secretary of the Treasury who would be the most important person. But I've always wanted to have a Jewish strongman. There's not enough Jewish dictators outside of Netanyahu. I really wanted a nice Jewish strongman. So I had a Defense Secretary Rubenstein, who was also completely incompetent, too.
You tell the book in two different first persons, his and hers. Why that approach?
I've always wanted to write from the point of view of a woman, you know, a young
woman
in this case. I never have until
it's always— Even in short stories?
No. It's always some big, you know, schlumpy Jewish guy. Ah, look at me. I wanted to try something different to have and she's a daughter of Korean immigrants, so she has a very particular kind of syntax. And she's also Southern Californian. So she has all these different sides to her that I think make her very expressive in a different way than what you're used to seeing in literature.
Well, one of the things, as you pointed out earlier, that hasn't changed in this new world is that immigrant parents still push their children to succeed.
Yes. No, of course. I went to Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, where I still remember my average, which is the same as Lenny Abramov's average, 86.894. I remember our parents would go bananas if we only got into Cornell or University of Pennsylvania. Princeton! Where Princeton? It still shocks me to this day.
There are a lot of National Guard checkpoints staffed by soldiers with guns. What are they guarding?
Nothing. There's nothing left to guard. You always know a country's in bad shape when there's a lot of tanks and nothing to guard. I mean, that was the former Soviet Union. You would show up and there'd be, you know, checkpoints everywhere and people standing around, and there was no economy left.
And people are instructed to forget that they saw the checkpoints. Did they do that in the Soviet Union?
In the Soviet Union, you knew to forget pretty quickly. The moment you saw anything bad, you avert your eyes.
When you look at the latest thing I just read the other day, that Vladimir Putin sang old Soviet songs with these returned alleged spies, although I haven't figured out what they ever spied about. And that struck me as really odd.
It's not really that odd. I mean, Russia is desperate.
Soviet songs?
Desperate. The Soviet times were the best times for Russia in centuries. I mean, after Peter the Great, there was nothing for a while. Then Stalin, he was pretty great in terms of making the country feel like it's a giant superpower. Russia and America, these are why maybe I'm so lucky to have these two countries to write about. Russia and America are both ginormous countries. They're too big for their own good at times, and they have these messianic ideas about what they are. I wasn't lucky enough to be born in Denmark or Italy or some other small country with a faded past. I had to grow up in these two failing empires. Get me out of here.
Well, and it was interesting that we were both countries that developed late and wound up at each other's throats.
Right, exactly. No, we're this is a bad Mexican wrestling match that we're in, you know.
You're a contributing editor for Travel and Leisure magazine. Did they send you to places other than Eastern Europe?
Yeah. After a while, they stopped. You know, I said, look, no more Azerbaijan. I can't eat another kebab.
And Azerbaijan is a fascinating country.
It is a fascinating country. But in my last book,
caviar there.
You can get delicious caviar. I once swam in a sea of caviar. It was obscene. They were sending me to wonderful places, Hong Kong, where I wrote about the 20 best restaurants in Hong Kong. In fact, all this stuff goes back to my books. There's a lot of wonderful scenes about Korean cuisine in Super Sad True Love Story, where these two characters really fall in love more while eating a very spicy cabbage.
Yeah, I remember when we first talked, I guess it was when your first novel was published, and you seemed to be rather ambivalent about living in the United States, even though you came here when you were seven, mm-hmm. went back to Russia. Have you always felt like you've never really become the citizen of any place?
Well, I love New York. I love New York so much. And that's why it's been so hard for me in this book to, not to give away too much, but to at least partially destroy it or to see it destroyed in the book. Because and some of my friends who have read this said, you know, we can feel that you're actually touched by what you're writing here because you're not just dealing with some abstract, absurdistan kind of country. It's the Duane Reeds that are on fire at this point, and that means something to you and to us, obviously.
Well, dystopic novels are always about the destruction of something that was once wonderful but that went into serious decline.
Sure, sure. Well, going from Soviet Union to Hebrew school, that's exactly what I experienced, the endless dystopia, institutions in freefall, really.
You often go back to Russia, don't you? But your parents won't?
They don't want to go. They're
ever?
No, that's
they have
you know,
no nostalgia.
Yeah, they have nostalgia.
No curiosity about how it's changed.
I think they have nostalgia, but I think their experiences with anti-Semitism, and, you know, it's the Mel Gibson of countries. They just don't want to go back there and face it.
And what's your feeling? Is there some hope for Russia, or does it remain the Mel Gibson of countries?
It's possibly the Lindsay Lohan of countries.
Isn't it ironic that he had a Russian girlfriend?
Let's see. Yeah, he beats his wife. He's drunk all the time, and he hates Jews. Perfect. I go back because I'm fascinated, and also I go back because I want to find out more about who I am and who my parents are. You know, I think this is the kind of pilgrimage that many Americans, Irish, Jewish, Italians, that they make to try to understand where they're from. There's something beautiful about it, but there's also something depressing about it. And after I spent 2 weeks getting trashed with my friends and walking around in a daze and hugging statues of Pushkin and whatnot, after that, I just want to get on the next plane and go home.
Well, you write in English because English is really your language.
Yeah.
Could you write in Russian? Obviously produced a lot of great literature.
Well, of course. No, I'm very influenced to this day by 19th century Russian literature, which I still think is the golden age of literature. You know, they had it a little easier back then, I think. You know, as novelists, you know, Tolstoy, when he was writing about war and peace, he was in the 1860s, he was writing about 1812. But a horse was still a horse, and a carriage was still a carriage. There may have been some things, you know, but he didn't have to write about the latest killer app or Facebooker or whatever, you know, or any of this thing, because now to write about the present is nearly impossible because there is no present. Everything is set entirely to the future. So not being a blogger, being a novelist, I feel like I'm a little bit handicapped, which is why I write so fast. I try to have a new book out every 3 or 4 years, not just to come on your show, which is wonderful, but also to actually have a book out.
Well, I'd imagine that the only way that you could take advantage of the current situation is to set a book very specifically in a certain moment. So that when you talk about some app on an iPhone or whatever, everybody will understand it as something that happened in the year 2010 in July.
Yes, but it all happens so
quickly. The iPhone 4, antenna, you know.
The antenna, right. The thing is, so much information is being thrown at us that I sometimes forget who I am, where I live, what my address is. I've been run over by so many cabs because I'm walking with my iPhone 12 and it's beeping at me and pinging at me. And I forget to look around me and I forget to see the world around me.
Your hero in this book, Lenny, works at Statling Wapichung Corporation, which, among other things, sells life extension. What do they do?
The idea is that, and this is not my idea, there are thinkers like Ray Kurzweil, Audrey LeGray, who have these ideas about the fact that life extension may be right around the corner for a certain group of people. And the way to get there, there's so much science behind it that it's hard to explain. But in my book, a very small elite thinks that it's going to live forever. And Lenny, my guy, you know, he works for this corporation, and his dream is to live forever. He has this young girlfriend, Eunice Park, who he's completely in love with. Finally, he doesn't want to die. And the fruits of immortality are right around the corner. He just can't afford them. It's very sad.
On the other hand, he's working for an important company. I would have thought that would have given him a higher rating.
Yeah, well, his stability rating is very high, but there's a rating I can't pronounce on the radio, which is quite low. But he, you know, this is when I was growing up. I was like all great writers. Hopefully, should be very sick as children because that creates a lot of downtime. And I was incredibly sick, and the ambulance would come all the time to my Leningrad apartment and take me to the Soviet hospital. Not so great. And so from the very first beginning, I thought I'm afraid of death. And I would even write it in my little child's diary, you know, 1 year, 3 months. I don't want to die yet, you know. Should I be drinking pomegranate juice? Help.
And what happened? How come your health improved?
Well, when we came to America, they have things here like asthma inhalers that they never heard of them in Russia. And, you know, and I don't just eat butter for breakfast with a shot of vodka. You know, some margarine and maybe some... you know, a Negroni or something.
Let's hope you don't become an alcoholic and beat your wife.
Well, I'd have to move to Santa Monica for that, I guess.
Gary Steingart will be reading and signing books tomorrow at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store at 7 o'clock. And then on Thursday at the Book Review in Huntington at 7 o'clock. Friday at the Greenlight Bookstore on Fulton Street in Brooklyn. That's at 7 p.m. as well. I guess you enjoy doing the book tour.
I love meeting people. They're so sweet. I love my audiences because they're so diverse. You know, some of them are so lovely and young, and some people come with an oxygen tank behind them. And I just love the fact that I have so many readers from so many different places.
Gary Steingart's book is Super Sad, True Love Story. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.